You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Naomi Nussbaum, Executive Director of One Family, an organization that provides emotional, psychological, financial, and legal support to bereaved families, severely wounded civilians and soldiers, and children in Israel. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. You know, mid-August in most parts of America is late summer, but here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, it's supposed to be fall somehow. School started for K through 12 kids 2 weeks ago. Hebrew school's begun for Jewish students, and the University of Arizona starts its classes next week. Traffic, which mostly disappeared for the last 2 months, has ticked up too. People are returning from their summer vacations. It's still abominably hot, you understand, but for us Tucsonans, life has resumed in full after 2.5 months of relative quiet, which makes this a good time to assess where we are, I think. In Hebrew calendar terms, we're in the month of Av, a summertime month, but in a little over a week, we'll begin the month of Elul, final month of the Jewish calendar. That's a time for introspection, repentance, and repair, a month in which we evaluate the past year personally and see how we can improve in the coming year. The month before that, of this one, is a good time to reflect on where we are in a little bit broader sense, before our annual effort to fix what's broken about our lives and amend our personal errors. Which means, since we are members of society and live in a larger world, it's a good time to evaluate just where we think our own country is right now. Now, I know this is a Jewish show. You may have noticed that too, but I'll begin with some wisdom from the Far East. There's a famous Chinese curse: may you live in interesting times. It seems, my friends, we are fated for just that sort of experience, living in interesting times. The past 7 months in America have been about as strange as any period I can remember in my entire life. There have been years when greater shocks occurred, like 9/11, now 24 years ago, or October 7, 2023, with the Gaza War atrocities perpetrated by Palestinian terrorists. But these didn't seem quite so crazy as things are now. Even in the first part of the first Trump presidency back in 2017, things in the U.S. did not move in the extraordinary ways they are moving now. From a Jewish perspective, there have been both positive and profoundly negative things happening kind of all the time. To recap, a number of people were appointed and now hold positions in the Trump administration who seem to embody the exact opposite of what you would want in those roles. We have a Health and Human Services Secretary who doesn't believe in vaccinations, or perhaps the germ theory of disease, or maybe gravity. We have a Secretary of Defense who seems not to understand what top secret means, and who appears to be far over his head in the job. An Attorney General who can't keep her own story straight on a sex scandal that may or may not involve the president, and who treats weaponization of the American legal system for partisan purposes to be a central tenet of her job. We have a Secretary of Homeland Security who is far better at putting herself on TV wearing military costumes than at providing emergency services to flood victims, even in deep red states. We have a Director of National Intelligence who is a conspiracy theorist, who belongs to a religious cult, and is quite possibly a Russian agent, and on and on. You know, for a while, the richest man in the world was put to work, unpaid, cutting out large swaths of the federal government, including a variety of essential services that had irked him somehow. The financial savings, the huge ones we were supposed to realize from all this slashing and burning, apparently was all imaginary. and a great deal of national functionality was severely damaged in a very short period of chaotic time. Oh, then the rich guy got in a fight with his new bestie, the president, walked away from the project, and both he and the president trashed each other publicly. And that was just the first couple of months. Since then, we've seen people fired from high and important positions because they were honest or presented accurate statistics on the economy or were black or women or not sufficiently partisan. We've watched as the sweet land of liberty made a public show of deporting both legal and illegal immigrants, including occasionally some citizens, in the ugliest way possible and with awful human consequences. This was really all just a show, because fewer people are actually being deported now than were kicked out under the last administration. You know, the Biden administration. But it demonstrates that we don't want foreigners coming to America anymore, even though all of our families came here from somewhere else, and the president is married to an immigrant. As Jews, seeing the demonization of immigrants and the dehumanization of temporary residents is ugly and distressing. We Jews know what it's like to flee oppression and seek freedom in a new land. That has always been just what America represented, but not now. We've also watched as a U.S. budget was passed that promised to dramatically increase national debt and national deficit, seen a trade war initiated against our closest allies, filled with inflationary tariffs, watched as a variety of medical and humanitarian projects of great value were shut down instantly out of both policy and pique. And let us not forget the use of the U.S. military on American soil at a level we haven't seen since the Civil War, maybe? Reconstruction? The deployment of the National Guard in a fake war on crime in order to suppress protesters lest free speech become an American value. Oh, wait, free speech is supposed to be a value guaranteed by our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Maybe not anymore. We can't begin to explore what our administration's foreign policy is now because it's not clear there is a coherent approach to advancing American interests abroad at all. We certainly appreciate the support that has been shown to Israel, which has been valuable and consistent. It is not so clear, however, how the climate of requiring knee-bending and kissing the ring is going to play in other parts of the world, or how destroying alliances and moral standards in international conduct is going to work out long-term, nor how the kind of institutionalized corruption being perpetrated by this administration to directly benefit the president can possibly do anything but damage our country's image everywhere. There are some areas of policy that we as Jews should appreciate in the midst of our current national chaos. The steady U.S. Justice Department pressure against the anti-Semitic waves that rolled across our nation ever since October 7, 2023, all that matters. And it might help that it is being handled in the most heavy-handed way conceivable as a systematic method to bring universities and colleges into subservience to the current administration's will in every area by threatening to stop all their funding because they allowed anti-Semitism to flourish. Well, that approach is at best troubling. It will undoubtedly lead to a backlash down the road, just you watch. But it certainly has changed the conversation on campuses across the U.S. about anti-Semitism, and that could prove to be incredibly important. I certainly hope so. Look, from a Jewish perspective, all this chaotic action in just 7 months leads to serious concern. We have long benefited from the American way of life and the freedoms of a democratic America in which, generally speaking, the rule of law obtained. The rise of anti-Semitism now has had a chilling effect on the Jewish community here already. Concerns about the future of a country that seems to be teetering farther and farther toward authoritarianism are certainly troubling Jews who have rarely benefited from authoritarian regimes and often been the victims of them. Look, I think most Jews in America are simply going about their business, living their lives, and hoping it all gets less insane and, well, better. but some are in fact moving abroad to places they feel may be better for Jews in the long run, better than America. Unfortunately, Israel doesn't seem like the best destination right now, now does it? Well, my friends, we live in interesting times indeed. May they prove to be less troubling going forward, perhaps even a bit less chaotic. In an upbeat mode to play us in on this hot August morning, here's a compilation song by Yitzi Hurwitz that includes a lot of Jewish music stars from all over the world, ranging from Yehoram Gaon to Benny Friedman to Gad Elbaz to the Maccabees. It's called Shine a Little Light. It's a song Hurwitz wrote before he was diagnosed with ALS.
Can't you see I'm trying to be all that you want of me? But it's so cold now, it's so dark here. What could I do? It's not very clear.
Shine a little light, show us the way, lead us to a brighter day.
If I'm a little light, you're a little light. Together we are so very bright. A little light here,
a little light there. See the smiles, it's so very clear.
Shine a little light, show us the way. Lead us to a brighter day. Shine a little light,
show us the way, lead us to a brighter day.
Shine a little light, show us the way, lead us to a brighter day. Shine a little light, show us the way.
The upbeat Shine a Little Light by Yitzi Hurwitz. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Naomi Nussbaum, the executive director of an extraordinary organization, One Family, will tell us what it does. Well, it helps victims of terror and trauma and their families in Israel, and it does so in some amazing ways. One Family has had its hands full ever since October 7, 2023. Find out what they do and how they do it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Naomi Nussbaum. She's the executive director of One Family, which she has been for the last 5 years. She works on a remarkable program at One Family, healing trauma, but in particular working with the survivors of terror attacks in Israel and, well, a variety of other people who have experienced some of this awful trauma and finding extraordinary ways to help them recover. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about One Family, how it began and how you got involved.
Sure. One Family provides emotional, financial, and legal support to all of Israel's terror victims. It started because the day of the Sparrow bombing was on Michal Belzberg's bat mitzvah day, her 12th birthday, and the Belzberg family decided they did not want to celebrate. They couldn't have a party when the nation was in mourning,
right.
And that's exactly how they felt. So because the party was a few weeks out, they had enough time to cancel it. And at the Bat Mitzvah Project, they had Michal go and visit all of the Shiva homes and all the victims in the hospital room. And she asked, how can I help? She got to know them. She heard their stories and very quickly realized that the large amount of money that they were donating wasn't nearly enough to accommodate all the needs. And 2 weeks later, a bus was blown up and the Belzbergs knew that this was their calling.
The process of responding to horrible terror attacks is usually, people usually understand the immediacy of the issue. There are dead, there are wounded, there is recovery of bodies, there's funerals, there's the physical recovery, but the emotional recovery, not only of the direct victims, but of their families and close friends, that doesn't happen quite so quickly. Tell us when they kind of began to come, how One Family came to terms with that and some of the ways it began to develop programming.
Well, they realized that nobody was taking care of the victims at that time. Nobody was bringing them together. There's, you know, a government stipend that you get, but it's not the same as taking care of somebody. You know, they were orphaned from that Sparrow bombing. You know, two little girls who were terrified, right? They needed a lot of help and hand-holding, not just bureaucracy, making sure that they get adopted by somebody, whether they're leaving the country or staying in the country, right? And there was a mother in the hospital. Her baby wasn't harmed, but she was, right? And who's watching the baby? And the stroller is soaked with blood. So they realized the victims felt very alone and very afraid. And that's when they started to notice, right, that they wanted to be for the victims who didn't have family to take care of them. And they started a national support family, bringing them all together with support groups and trauma therapy. They opened their heart and they started programming where it was needed.
Now, that attack took place August 9th, 2001. You know, that's 24 years ago now. Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary that I feel sort of guilty. Two Jewish has been on the air since 2002. I didn't know about this program until quite recently. The kinds of responses to terrorism or really to helping victims who have been through trauma were certainly profoundly needed then, but we'll talk when we come back on Two Jewish about the ways that they are being needed in particular now after the October 7, 2023 trauma and some of the new programs that One Family is doing. We'll be back in a moment with Naomi Nussbaum. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established 7 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is starting for school-age kids and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Torah Tikes programs for the youngest kids, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. Our services, classes, and events are open to everyone Friday night. Services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat, available in person and on our Facebook page. Shabbat morning, Saturday, Torah study is at 9 a.m., with services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also come to services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org for more information. To attend services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and the coming High Holy Days for 5786, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. I trust you are all keeping cool over this long, hot summer in the Southwest. Global warming seems to have occurred in my personal space this time. I only hope we can all again experience some coolness soon. To keep you cool, we welcome back an occasionally and inscrutably recurring feature of 2 Jewish, the ever-popular insights of Zen Judaism. Here are some koans of Zen Judaism. Be patient and achieve all things. Be impatient and achieve all things faster. In nature, there is no good or bad, no better or worse. The wind may blow or not. The flowering branch grows long or short. Do not judge or prefer. Only ask, is it good for the Jews? Those were our Zen Judaism koans, insights for the week. I mean koans. May your week be placid and free of heartburn. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You just came back from a trip, as you frequently do, this one to the Northwest, and you got a story to share.
Right. Well, this trip was largely to get away from the heat. I was in Sun Valley, Idaho for a couple of days, and then in Portland, Oregon. And the highs in both those cities were in the 70s, and the lows at night were in the 50s, and it was extremely pleasant. But
You didn't really have to rub it in, Tom, but thanks.
Right, I know. In both cities, I visited friends from seventh grade in University City, Missouri. And we've stayed in touch somehow all these years. And both these guys, who grew up as, you know, nice Midwestern guys, married women who grew up in foreign countries and eventually became naturalized U.S. citizens with passports and speaking English without an accent, whatever, one from Austria and one from Japan. And what was very interesting to me was so the guy in Portland has a wife who's recovering from surgery, so she really couldn't go out, but she wanted to see me, so we, like, had drinks on their back patio, and then David and I went out. And while we were on the patio, David said, I'm sorry, I have to take this call. And it was from somebody named Nir. So I said to David, is Nir Israeli? And David said, no, actually, he's Greek somehow. I said, oh, what's his last name? Last name is Modiano. And I said, David, have you ever been to Thessaloniki? And I knew he hadn't, because he and his wife were supposed to come on the trip I led there last October, and they couldn't because of her surgery. So I said, if you had gone to Thessaloniki, you would have discovered that the main marketplace is called the Modiano Market, because the architect was a guy named Shmuel Modiano, who was one of the many Jews who arrived in Thessaloniki originally from Spain, but in many cases by way of a half century or a century or even two centuries in Italy. So a lot of them think of themselves as Italian Jews first. So he said, oh, that's fascinating. He's like, I'll have to ask Nir about this. So the next day he went on a hike with his friend Nir, and he texted me that night and said, Nir is amazed that you know more about his family history than he does.
You know, add something to that, which is my dad grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. One day he came back. He tells this story, and that's the only reason it triggered a button for me, although I do have been to Thessaloniki a couple times. I really enjoy it, as you've always spoken so highly of it. It's a fantastic place. But he came back and told his parents that he had just started dating a girl, and they said, what's her last name? And he said, Modiano. And they're like, she's what, Italian? He said, no, she's Sephardic Jewish. So apparently my dad once dated a girl named Modiano in Cincinnati, Ohio in the 1940s. So we've got an additional personal aspect to that.
It was a big family and a highly respected family in Thessaloniki. They were successful and prosperous and widely respected in the Jewish community there.
Very important community and still very interesting. There's still a Jewish community, still a Jewish community center there, which has kosher food and has a preschool and stuff. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An older couple invites friends for dinner. The husband entertains them while his wife is finishing up in the kitchen. We found an amazing restaurant the other day, the husband says. Great ambiance, awesome food. Really? The guest says. So what's it called? Ay, the name. Ach, the name of the restaurant. I know. It's on the tip of my tongue. I just can't remember. Say, what's the flower with thorns? It's usually red. You send on Valentine's Day? You mean a rose? That's it. Hey, Rose, what was the name of that restaurant?
the husband yells. That was the old Jewish joke of the week special feature of Two Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Re'eh, fourth Sedra, fourth portion in the book of Deuteronomy. It follows a sequence of marvelous portions with yet another remarkable text. Re'eh includes one of the most radical statements in the whole Torah. Ki yevachayev yon ne'achad achecha be'achad sharecha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates in the land the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. Ki fatoach tiftach et yadcha lo. You shall certainly open your hand to him and give him enough for whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. This commandment is not simply to provide the needs of the needy, not to alleviate their suffering, but to give them what they actually want: sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our own American society, in which the safety net seemingly has as many holes as net. It is more than the social protesters in Israel or around the world believe their society is providing. It is a powerful, dramatic, encompassing statement. Open your hand. Surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of the strong economic agenda of Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power. No one should be left destitute. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need in order to survive decently. Herein lies a foundational lesson on the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion, give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity, and do so in a way that preserves the recipient's own dignity. That is the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly and in righteousness. At its heart, Judaism is pragmatic ethics. We're trained to make the world morally better through practical action. After exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity need to give something to those with less, the rabbis conclude tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of our income, not a hard figure, and that the same percentage, whether 10% or 5% of gross income or some other number, should be given in good times and bad, even in crazy, strange, weird times. It's true that when there is less income, there will be a smaller amount donated. But the percentage, and thus the integrity of the individual's morality, must be preserved through tzedakah. So, my friends, open your hand. Give a percentage of your gross income to help others. Do so freely and generously, in good times and in tough times, at all times. It's the Jewish thing to do. It's the right thing to do. When we return in a moment on Two Jewish, our guest, Naomi Nussbaum, executive director of One Family, explains how they help trauma victims in Israel and how central their work is and how it has expanded. Find out when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world, with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
The Toronto International Film Festival has rescinded its invitation to screen an Israeli documentary about Hamas's October 7, 2023 war crime attack on Israel, in part over concerns that the filmmakers did not have Hamas's right to use its own footage from the deadly day. The film festival, Toronto International Film Festival, also said it was seeking to avert a potential threat of significant disruption over the film. Some events focusing on Israeli perspectives on October 7th have faced protests from pro-Palestinian terrorist demonstrators who oppose Israel's response in Gaza. The documentary, called The Road Between Us, The Ultimate Rescue, tells the incredible story of retired IDF General Noam Tibon's rescue mission, a personal one, of his son Amir Tibon and his family, during Hamas's brutal attack on kibbutz Nachal Oz, where over a quarter of the residents were murdered or taken hostage. It was made by a Canadian filmmaker, Barry Avrich. The Toronto Festival said it withdrew its invitation to screen The Road Between Us because the filmmakers had not satisfied, quote-unquote, general requirements, including ensuring, quote, legal clearance of all footage, unquote. The Toronto Festival allegedly requested the filmmakers identify the Hamas-sourced footage in the documentary and provide added security due to any risks created by the screening. Hamas terrorists live-streamed and recorded some of their attacks on October 7th. The footage has already appeared widely, including in other documentaries about the day. The Toronto Festival's claim that the issue is clearance for Hamas film footage is absurd, said Creative Community for Peace, an entertainment industry advocacy group. Does anyone believe Hamas would authorize use of evidence of its own war crimes? This is a pretext, a bout of threats, protecting those who make them, rather than those targeted by them. The documentary's subject, Noam Thibon, said the Toronto Festival's decision to cancel the screening due to permission to use the Hamas footage was absurd and bizarre and constitutes further harm to the victims. The Toronto Film Festival has succumbed to pressure and threats and has chosen to silence and erase October 7th, Thibon said. My message to the festival management, the truth cannot be erased. The atrocities committed by Hamas cannot be erased or denied. The Canadian Center for Jewish and Israeli Affairs called on the Toronto Festival to reverse this decision immediately, adding that the decision marks a stain on the festival's reputation. It is unconscionable that the Toronto International Film Festival is allowing a small mob of extremists who use intimidation and threats of violence to dictate what films Canadians can see at the festival. This shameful decision sends an unmistakable message. Toronto's Jewish community, which has long played an integral role in the Toronto International Film Festival, is no longer safe or welcome. The film is set to be shown in early September in Toronto at a public screening, running parallel to the festival set up by the city's Jewish community. Film's creators said they will not be deterred by the setback. We are shocked and saddened that a venerable film festival has defied its mission and censored its own programming by refusing this film, the filmmaking team behind The Road Between Us wrote. We are not political filmmakers, nor are we activists. We are storytellers. We remain defiant. We will release the film. We invite audiences, broadcasters, and streamers to make up their own mind once they've seen it. A dramatization of Thibon's rescue of his son, written by the creators of Fauda, is also reportedly in the works. In other news, Pope Leo has consistently advocated for a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel since he assumed the papacy back in May. In his first Sunday address after assuming the papacy, he called for a ceasefire, increased humanitarian aid in Gaza, and the freeing of the hostages, adding he was deeply pained by what is happening in the Gaza Strip. His predecessor, Pope Francis, frequently drew backlash for his pro-Palestinian advocacy, including November 2024 when he called for an investigation into claims of genocide allegedly perpetrated by Israel in Gaza. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Naomi Nussbaum is the executive director of One Family, which helps with treatment of trauma of the families of victims of terrorism and I assume some of the victims themselves. Tell us what has changed for One Family since October 7th, 2023.
Well, on October 7th, about a very similar number of people were murdered, which would be the combined total of people murdered for the previous 23 years.
Right.
Meaning, since we were in business in 2001, right up to October 6th, we served a certain number of people, and that just about doubled the next day. And of course, there's an ongoing war, right? So we have to triple or quadruple in size to be able to handle the current need. That's just enormous. So it's horrific. I mean, the atrocities affected all of us. We are hiring as many therapists as we can, different kinds of therapists, and also doing everything we can to triple or maybe quadruple the annual budget, which means getting new donors. And you hadn't heard of us before, right? Because
no, I really hadn't. That's right.
Yeah, we spent almost no money on marketing. right? The Belzbergs wanted all the money to go to the victims.
To treat
they
them.
Really, right. from their heart, treat everybody like family. That's where it came from. They never meant to be an institution with a hierarchy and lots of levels and lots of events. It wasn't set up that way. It was just like this beautiful, amazing family with big hearts who felt very lucky, and they could see real devastation, and they wanted to do everything that they could to help, right? So we did not spend a lot of money on marketing, and a lot of people don't know about us, but we are the largest organization in Israel doing this kind of work, helping terror victims with emotional support, financial support, and legal support. Nobody else does what we do.
You know, I was in Israel now a year and a half ago, and it seemed to me the whole country had some form of PTSD at that point. In addition to the kinds of medical treatment, you guys have pioneered, I think really one family has, taking sort of retreats to have survivors kind of create their own family amongst themselves. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, when they bond with peers in similar situations, those peers become part of their life throughout the year, forever. Nobody can truly understand the pain of the situation that they're in except for somebody else who's going through the exact same thing. So it's a different kind of support. Of course, we have trauma therapists, and we have psychologists and psychiatrists, and we can follow the top of the bar models for trauma treatment, but nothing will comfort a victim like another victim who understands exactly what they're going through. So those people become each other's families on birthdays, on your side, on holidays, on just a regular day when somebody feels like they just can't get out of bed. You know, they really can lean on each other. And of course, our coordinators are always there for them too. But these people bond for life, and that's something beautiful that comes out of this.
You know, I think that people don't quite understand that when there are survivors of terrible destruction like October 7th, just awful atrocities, their families are gone for some of them. There's some stories that you've sent around. This is, in a way, a kind of replacement family.
It can be a replacement family. We don't mean to replace biological relatives, you know, but sometimes within the family unit, it's very hard for people to deal with grief. They deal with grief in different ways, or they're grieving a different relationship. If, you know, a 19-year-old soldier is killed, the siblings are going to grieve one way and the parents are going to grieve differently. And the surviving children not only have to deal with the death of a beloved sibling, but then their parents also aren't taking care of them the same way that they used to. So they're kind of also mourning for that parent, right?
And of course, yeah.
Just so things get complicated, right? And if a bereaved mother or father have other bereaved mothers and fathers help them get through it and give them pointers for how to take care of the surviving children when they feel really overcome with devastation and grief over the loss of one child, maybe that's the best advice they'll get because it's so real and practical and heartfelt from somebody else.
There's an additional challenge I would expect with October 7th survivors. As you know, sometimes if somebody's family member is killed or horribly wounded or whatever in a bus bombing or a cafe bombing, they still have a home to go back to. That wasn't true for many of the October 7th survivors. Tell us sort of how one family dealt with that and continues to deal with that.
Goodness. You know, I met a young man named Hadar who's 25. His home was destroyed, his parents, his younger brother, the dog, everything he owned, right? Because he decided to go to Eilat the day before college started.
That's why he wasn't there and why he wasn't killed.
Correct. That's why he's alive, right? And the total devastation and void is overwhelming, you know, and just meeting him and spending time with him changed my perspective on that. I don't think most people can understand just how overwhelming the grief is. For most of those people, they were able to stay with the living residents of their kibbutz, even if they were relocated to a hotel. And they're all grieving together. They lost so many people from their communities, and they lost their farms. The good thing is that many people around the world reached out to help them. The people who were displaced received lots and lots of support, all kinds of it. So one family is strategic, where we put our aid. And when there's a big ticket, like when there's something very popular, like displaced people from the kibbutzim in the south, if they're receiving enough aid from everybody else, we don't have to do too much. Now, in the first couple of days, we set up a 24-hour emergency hotline, and we had hundreds of volunteers come to bake and put together care packages because the people didn't have food and basic supplies, blankets, toothbrushes. So we made boxes and boxes and boxes, and we had volunteers driving all over to dangerous parts, right, to make sure that everybody had the basics. So we did that. But when aid started flooding in specifically for them, then we can pull back and help the people who aren't being helped.
Tell us about the summer retreat for, I know it's, your name is Naomi, but for Naomi and Ruth.
Yes. Somebody made a very clever analogy, right? We had a retreat for mother-in-laws and daughter-in-laws. Basically, if a man was killed in the army, he left behind a mother and a wife. And sometimes that relationship is tricky. They're both grieving differently. One is grieving for a husband and one is grieving for a child. And we wanted to honor that relationship and help bring them together and help them understand the other person's grieving process and bring them a little bit closer together so that the pain doesn't pull them farther apart. And we've done that. It's a creative type of retreat, you know, a creative pairing of relatives. It was deliberate because we've lost so many soldiers and reservists. And we also, you know, we created groups for bereaved grandparents who are not traditionally recognized within our system of mourning. However, we've lost so many young soldiers and reservists that we couldn't ignore all the grandparents who aren't technically sitting Shiva, but they feel like it, right? We also have new support groups for parents whose daughters are young widows, right? So again, probably grandparents, but how do you help your daughter when she's a young widow? And what happens to the children or the grandchildren, right? Grandparents are now becoming caregivers. Maybe they were retired, or maybe they work, or maybe they have to give up their job to help their daughter who's now a widow. So we're coming up with creative new support groups that are really needed because of this situation in Israel.
Now, one family works not only with Jewish Israelis, but Jews, Muslims, Druze, Christians, and everybody. How do people, what's the intake like? How does it work?
You know, we reach out to people. That's it.
So it's not really an intake. It's an outreach, really.
Yes, it's outreach. When there's a specific attack, we go to the hospital, or we show up at the funeral, and we show up at the Shiva home. We go there, right? On October 7th, there was too much. I mean, we were doing that, but it was just too big and out of the scope. So we publicized, you know, we're having an event for bereaved parents in the South. Please show up at this time, at this date. And, you know, young people in Tel Aviv, if you just lost a sibling, we're going to have an event for you here, and widows in Jerusalem, right? So we were just publicizing the support group events as far and wide as we could and asking people to show up. But our usual way of operating is to reach out to the victims directly. And usually it's in the news. And within 5 minutes, you can find somebody who lives in that community who will tell you who this person is and where they live, and you can just show up.
Just kind of a pragmatic question. How many therapists are involved in working with one family? Are there people that do it full time? Is it a network of people? How do you find the therapist to do the work?
Okay, excellent question. So some of our caseworkers, who are like social workers and coordinators, they coordinate the entire therapeutic plan. They've been with us for decades. So they stay and they're trained, right? And then we have a whole host of other people, and some of them are full-time, some of them are part-time, some of them are volunteers, some of them have grown up in our system and are now giving back, you know, again, there's right. some really beautiful, touching things that happen at one family. So, you know, we might hire contractors or we can employ them. I'll tell you one story. There's a woman named Yael whose husband was murdered, and she was left alone to raise six young children. And she was in our programs for about 6.5 years. Her children went to the youth camp, to all the programming throughout the year. They really looked forward to it. And when October 7th happened, she knew that she had to reach out to the New Widows. And she volunteered for 2 months, and then we gave her a job, right? Like,
right.
More qualified to speak to the widows and lead the widows division than a widow, right?
Of course.
So it's a magical combination. And it's the same thing with our bereaved siblings department, right? Somebody runs it who lost a sibling, and the director in Israel had a death in his family, and his job in the army was to inform families when we lost somebody. So many people in our organization, whether they have a formal degree or they have an informal degree, have all been touched by terror.
Naomi, I want to thank you for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to help, to find out more about One Family and to support it?
Thank you. They can come to overcometerror.com, overcometerror.com, or they can email me, Naomi@onefamilyfundus.org. And our phone number is 646-289-8600.
And that's One Family, O-N-E-F-A-M-I-L-Y. Naomi, thank you so much, and thank you for the great work that you do.
Thank you so much.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Two Jewish. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha Friday night. Services and Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes from Ari Goldwag. It's called Lo Nafsik Lirkod. Don't stop dancing. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Two Jewish is sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
Hofech et kol hara letov. נותן לנו הכוח להמשיך לשמוח.